What is going on, you guys? It is Dollar Cost Crypto here with the Boomer Collapse is coming. What is up, you guys, man? It's good to see you guys in the chat right now. Send it, baby. Sheesh. Hit the like button, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and we ready to go, man. I'm going to do a reaction to a couple videos from a YouTube channel called Economics Explained. And these are two kind of boomer, I would say boomer-ish light concentrated videos, basically, where it's kind of talking about like just things that they did that's going to affect the downstream markets, both in crypto and in the real estate market and in the stock market. Realistically, I think a lot of people there's something that I've been saying on the past streams and stuff about the real estate market, that where is all this extra supply going to come from, right? Well, a lot of people don't actually know this. Like, at one point, I was going to try to work for Fidelity, and I was going to end up eventually going to work out with, you know, helping people with retirements. And one thing that I kind of learned in terms of me learning about, you know, just economics, stocks and everything is just usually, I mean, it's kind of the retirement space, right? About like, how do you make a portfolio, right? A big portfolio that was really pushed for a long time was this 60-40 portfolio, which was 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And then that's the classic portfolio where it's just kind of static and they kind of stay within that range. And then there's more of a nuanced sort of portfolio nowadays where like you start off with like 90-10. And then as you progressively get older, it leans completely into bonds by the time you're getting ready to like actually retire, which is, I honestly think they're both terrible ideas for portfolios personally, but I get it. People don't want to, like, if it's more of like a passive thing, where, because people are very bad at saving money, and we used to have pensions here in the States, and now we're mostly a 401k sort of country. There still is some pensions. I think there might be like 8% of companies still offer pensions, but we're mostly 401ks for the most part, with some level of matching, which is basically like, hey, if you take $4,000 a year out of your paycheck, we are going to also give you an additional $4,000 from the company's money and stuff like that. But it's basically a shitty model, and I think, and truly believe, I believe you should have fully control of your money, and you should try to put that money towards something that actually can be productive, where actually you can grow it. I think you'd be better off just, if you only had stocks or bonds, I think you'd just be better off just investing into just stocks themselves and just trying to pick them yourselves. I mean, literally, if you just picked into some of the top couple companies, you'd do very well for yourself. But the thing is, people are very irresponsible, and this is kind of why I think the power of the pension was so powerful, because so people are very bad at saving money or having that investor mindset. A lot of you guys who watch my channel are the kind of people that could do this sort of thing, you know, DYOR, do your own research, not even do your own research, but, you know, do your own sort of like investment portfolio or actually try to gain wealth in the system because you guys are proactive about your money. A lot of people don't even have that mindset. Even people that I know and I love and dear, like love dearly and stuff like that, I tell them about investments and stuff and they don't do it because it's just, I really believe there is some people in their mentality that they just, they don't really believe in that sort of thing, or it's just not a part of their personality. Or maybe, but I think, I really believe that money is this thing that we all use and we really should care about it, but I feel like a lot of people don't really like take it very seriously. It's always like kind of kicking the can down the road, if that makes sense. But yeah, also don't forget about poor man's retirement Social Security. Yeah, of course, and that's a part of the social. You want to know something? This is a crazy statistic. Like, most people, now this is people who have saved something for their 401ks, more or less most people's like retiring today or close to retirement today have about $400,000 to $700,000 in the 401k, which sounds like, oh fuck, that's a lot of money. But if you guys know about money, that's nothing. How the hell is $400,000 or $700,000 going to last you? You know what I'm saying? Like, that much money, even if it was all in dividend stocks, you'd be lucky. I mean, you'd be lucky if you got like $18,000, like on a $700,000 portfolio, you'd be lucky if you got $18,000 in dividends. And that's equating, like, you have 3%. Every stock that you have in there is paying you 3%. Even if it was on bonds, and maybe there's some of these bonds are paying you 4 to 5%, you may be able to get $28,000. And then plus, you know, Social Security, maybe another $14,000. So you're basically living at like $40,000 a year. But then from there, I mean, with the increasing costs that are going on in life and stuff like that, it just barely squeaks you by, basically. Like, I mean, this is a quote that I've got told by multiple people that I used to work with and stuff. These are boomers, and then these are all boomers that told me this. Good people, but they told me this is like, Miguel, the worst thing in the world is to be old and broke. There ain't nothing worse than that. I mean, yeah. Oh, you said the Pepe's down, right?
You want me to run it right now?
Let me try it. Let's see.
Let's go.
Does it work? Oh, it just worked. There we go. Yay. That's beautiful. Whoa, okay. Different transition there. But yeah, I'm super happy. We were having some technical difficulties for a minute, and then so we were like, no Pepe today, and I was like, tears down, running down my face.
Sad Pepe is now happy Pepe.
That's right.
And wealth Pepe behind you.
Right. REIT dividend stocks can pay a higher as 12%, but advertisers won't recommend them. Exactly, right, Kevin? Yeah, there is some REIT ones that pay you a lot, but then also they can, especially right now, like being in REITs, you're losing tons of money in the REITs as well, because real estate's also taken down. So you can actually have a slight recovery in stocks, but still be losing money, losing principal on that and stuff. But I guess it's all about like, there's a lot of people that lead into cash flow, which is pretty powerful. But if you actually looked at retirees, right, if you were actually to look like, oh, I want to retire, it's the people who actually were able to retire weren't the people who had a stock portfolio. Usually you would need some kind of a portfolio of like 3 million, 5 million to maybe have a chance of retiring and stuff like that. And it's still not even promised because things are just so crazy out here in this world. The people who actually were able to retire were people who had Social Security, had some children, had two properties paid off. Usually when you have two houses or two type of properties, what the way that a lot of people were able to squeak by the really retire, this is really the secret right here, is that you have some savings, you have some kids, you have your house paid off that you live in, and you're renting out another property. That renting out the other property is really what makes up the shortfall in your daily cash flow for the month and stuff like that. Extra $2,000 to $3,000, $4,000, depending on where you live, $4,000 of income, plus whatever's in the 401k, that, and then the Social Security, that is how, is actually the most likely, that's actually the archetype of the average person who would be, actually be able to sustainably retire. But most people were, but here's the thing, the average person, if now, the average person has a 401k, right? But, older generation, right? But most people would probably only have their house. So, you know, this is kind of like why I'm disagreeing with a lot of things is like over time as people are retiring, people tend to move, right? And because a lot of people are have kind of a shortfall where like they didn't save enough money, you know, the economy is pretty bad and, you know, just reckless spending, is that they're going to sell their house to get a lump sum of cash and then move to Florida, right? This is kind of the big thing. So this is one of the reasons why I think Florida as a state, their real estate market is going to be very strong for the next 15 years just because of all the retirees and people selling properties around the United States now. We're just having a lot of people that have been managing properties as their job, and a lot of them, even a person who has 10 houses, would more than likely over the next 10 years be selling those properties off just because they don't want to deal with the headache. You know, they're like, I haven't, like, people, owning real estate is still a job, you guys. Refi, baby. Yeah, that's what's going on. That's what's up, man. But, a lot of people, that's where the extra supply is going to come from, right? People are going to sell these properties off. Then, and this is kind of fucked up thing is because like some of them won't, and but some of them will. But I would imagine a lot of people who are struggling with their things, I would probably say it's like more like a 60-40 split. 60% of people are probably going to stay in their single family home and live there. 40% are going to move across country to a better place, like Florida. I think that's a lot warmer for people anyway. Florida. And then live off the extra income from that property, but then burn through that capital over time. But that also puts a downwards pressure. These are properties that have been held onto for quite a long time that are going to be sold off over these next 10, 15 years as people retire. I think, what is it? I think it was like four or 8,000 people are retiring every single day in the United States right now. That's a crazy amount of people to be retiring. So you can imagine, like, if it's, let's just say I'm nice, let's say it's 8,000. So probably 2,000 homes are going to be put on the market within a year of them retiring, of them trying to move and, you know, accomplish their dreams. And I get it too. You know, people, you know, you finally are retiring and then you want to do that trip you've always wanted to do with the fam and stuff, or like, and you know, you'll sell the house, either for $400,000 to about $1 million on average, and take that trip and then buy the RV. So shout out to all the RVs, RV homes out here, man. We're metro booming out here in these streets. But let's get into it, you guys. Economics Explained is a channel that I really like. It's a little poppy and stuff like that, but it's a great channel. I think they talk about some cool things, and I'm going to go over two videos as well as just before I start. This Saturday, I'm going to do a HEX stream. So this is going to be kind of my take on what's going on in the HEX ecosystem. I'm going to go over everything, HEX, Pulse, even how to stake as well, and kind of like my newest strategy for staking and my kind of do's and don'ts of staking and not staking. It's going to be a heavy-duty Pulse chain, HEX ecosystem, Dark Triad, Holy Trinity, Thanos Gauntlet. Oh, I haven't put this baby on in a minute, man. Thanos Gauntlet. Level stream and stuff like that. The Infinity Stones are all in the gauntlet today. It's going to be a massive stream on Saturday at 1 p.m., right, Travis? Yeah, at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Saturday, we're doing the stream. If there's ever is a change, I am getting surgery tomorrow, so might be blind for that. So if there is a change, I might change it to Saturday or something like that, or maybe Monday. I'll give you guys a heads up. I don't know. I'm getting LASIK, so we'll see. If I might be blind, I might be on the blind on the stream and stuff. So this is a T-shirt, Miguel. That's the chart to XRP. Oh, so I might need somebody's help for that stream, but we'll get it done, you guys. So hit a Pepe, and then let's start this stuff, man. All right, full screen me, man. So this video right here, just full screen it, yeah. So this right here is the biggest wealth transfer in history is upon us, and this is a little bit of what I'm talking about when it comes to, this is both demographics and what's kind of going on in the space right now, is that you're having a lot of baby boomers go from stock heavy, adding to portfolios, to stopping adding to portfolios, and then net sellers to net sellers of houses. So they're going from kind of risk on, sort of adding to a portfolio, to risk off. And kind of taking money out instead of providing into the system, they're now going to draw upon the system, and this is going to have ramifications into the whole world market. This is one of the reasons why, outside of what's going on in the macro sense and stuff like that, rates were going to rise regardless because the baby boomers were getting into this age requirement, and when people hit around 40 to 50 years old, they kind of hit this point in time where they largely become net influencers into the equities markets and the kind of the worldwide market. And this, because they were the largest population in the world history, they drove down the cost of money. This is kind of a little bit why we not the entire reason, but kind of a reason why we had 0% interest rates for the last, I would say, 13, 14 years, since 2009, I would imagine, from 2009 till now, up until, beginning of 2022, I'm sorry. So pretty long time, you guys. I mean, damn near, what is that, 12, 13 years of, 0% rates, basically, or rates going to zero. And now we're going to head into a period where we're probably going to have non-zero rates for about, I would say, 5 years until the millennials start entering. I think the oldest millennial right now is 42 years old, if I recall correctly, or 40 years old. And over the next 5 years, we're going to start getting a lot of these older millennials and starting to really put money into the stock market. And this is going to start putting pressure back down on how much money costs around the world. And after that, we're going to enter, I think, another 15-year bull market off of the millennials entering as the people in control of the entire world markets. So that means pretty much somewhere between 2028, 2029 till about, I would say, 42 to 43. We're going to enter in some really good markets. Obviously, there's going to be crashes in there, just like there was crashes in the 70s, 90s, and early 2000s. But it's going to be 15, 20-year bull market because the millennials are in control, which is nice. But it's not going to be completely perfect because there's hiccups along the rest of the world. Most of the rest of the world did not have a big replacement generation like the millennials in other countries. We had one in the United States. I think the millennial generation is 5 to 10% bigger than the boomer generation. And on average, most developed countries around the world, their millennial generation is 40% smaller than their boomer generation to 60% smaller, like in China, which is not good. So those systems are going to be put into a complete kind of a stressful situation, and this is kind of one of the reasons why we believe that deglobalization is kind of going on, because these countries really can't maintain their status right now. So we're going to have some fireworks happening in the next 10 years. So I think we're going to have a plenty good time here in the States and in, I would say, Canada, Mexico, UK eventually, and then Japan. But even Japan's suffering through these sort of things right now. I mean, the Bank of Japan is printing billions or trillions of yen, but billions of billions of dollars trying to support their bond market, because more and more retirees, more of their boomer generation is entering a retirement, and they truly didn't, they had a baby bust, but they're essentially the oldest country, developed country in the world. And we're going to have to see what ends up happening with Japan. Japan's kind of like Japan's probably the best worst case scenario. They're the cleanest, dirtiest shirt, because they've already been entering this sort of thing. They kind of topped in the 90s or in the late 80s, and they've been kind of in this kind of baby bust sort of economy for the last 20 years. But we're really seeing the crux of this, of what happens when a country's mostly old people. So and they're the best case scenario, because they've kind of leaned into I would call automation, and we're going to see now what ends up happening with other countries who don't have that kind of prowess with technology and robots and kind of good connections with the US and stuff like that. So it's probably going to end up in famine and in a lot of, I would imagine, civil wars. So let's go into it, you guys.
It was left as one of the only manufacturing centers in the world that was not reduced to rubble. This led to one of the longest periods of sustained economic prosperity in history, as American industry rapidly improved the lives of a new wave of middle-class workers. This all coincided with a massive spike in birth rates, because, people had lived through years of grueling conflict and they were ready to start families. The generation formed by this boom in new babies needed a name, but the jury's still out on what that will be.
Boomers.
Generational naming conventions aside, these post-war babies are coming up against some harsh realities. Sad guarantees in life are death and taxes. We will actually cover both of those here, but the important one for now is that the wealthiest generation in history is starting to retire and die. In doing so, they will be responsible for the largest wealth transfer in history as they pass along a collective $30 trillion to their beneficiaries over the next few decades in the United States alone. That kind of capital movement is going to have some extremely significant impacts on the economy, some of which we are already starting to feel. So, what is actually being passed along? Will this stuff maintain its value in the hands of its new owners? Should we tax it? And finally, how...
Fuck no, we shouldn't tax it. Hell no. This is probably the biggest travesty. Like, I 100% disagree on taxing any of this sort of stuff. Like, imagine your parents work their whole damn life, and they finally pass along, and they leave you the house, and then you have to pay a huge tax bill on it, and then you can't afford to actually keep the house, and then they have to sell it. And this happens a lot. This is one of the reasons why there's so many trusts and there's so many corporations, but the average person doesn't really have that kind of set up for themselves. So I really believe a lot of these taxes just really just steal from the middle class and the lower classes and stuff like that. I mean, and as well as like to steal from like people who just newly got rich and stuff in their families. So huge, this whole death tax shit is a crock of shit. It's just the government is so bad at distributing money back to people that I really feel like this is like some horse shit right here. But we'll get into that later. Full screenness.
How might this actually be a huge economic problem? This episode of Economics Explained was made possible by Acorns, an investment app that
We're going to skip that whole
Acorns. Thanks, Acorn.
Thing. Hey, thanks, Acorn. You know what? Like, even though they're not sponsoring me or nothing like that, right? But I will say this, I did use Acorns for a long time, and it actually did help me out.
Really?
It really did. Now, I was pretty much one of the first people to start using Acorns back in the day and stuff like that. I found, because I was super turbo dork in the podcast game back in the day. So I was listening to like Fidelity. I was listening to the Bloomberg radio podcast. I was listening to Talking Stock with Prim Fox. I was listening. I mean, like every OG, the financial education, like, I mean, like all kinds of like these podcasts that were on the podcast app, the Apple podcast app. So I heard about, I would say Acorns pretty early on, and it's really cool. Actually, I would probably recommend for people who have trouble saving money and stuff, because it's really cool because it links up to your debit card. So every time you spend money, I'm fucking literally doing a fucking ad.
We're not sponsored, but
that's right. But let me give them a plug. But I will give them a plug because it did help out. Now, where they put the money into is like 401k sort of things, ETFs and stuff. And are you gonna make any money off that? No, you guys. But here's kind of the cool part of it is, like, let's just say you go to Costco or you go to like the convenience store, you put gas, you spend like $99.23. It'll put the other 87 cents or 73 cents or 83 or whatever the fuck cents into like an account for you. So it rounds it up to the nearest dollar. And then one cool thing you can do is like you can set it up like, okay, give my spare change plus a dollar or plus $3. So eventually I was doing something like every time I did a transaction, it would do $5 and some change. So over a month or two, I would save thousands of dollars, or $1,000, or $800, or $500, and basically I would use that as my little piggy bank, just like keep doing my stuff. So it was a way for me to actually drain myself even a little bit more to save, and then I would take that chunk of change after 3 months, pull it out, and then put it into stocks basically, and then I would pretty much YOLO it into like Apple or something like that to like get extra money. So like I actually would recommend this for some people, especially if like you want to. But the thing is like this whole bullshit of like putting into stocks is crock of shit. Now if Acorns added that feature where like, hey, we'll put it into Ethereum, I'm giving Acorn sauce right now. Yo, if they had a whole thing where like, hey, yeah, we'll distribute your thing into a 60-40 thing, even if it was 60-40 into a Bitcoin and Ethereum, my God, bros, I'd be like, sponsored by Acorns. What's going on, you guys? But I think that was a pretty cool thing. But anyway, you don't save yourself into $1 million, but saving some money gives you the capital to do things, to go out there. So you guys, like, because things are so crazy right now, you have to get into the rest of the risk curve. So you really, I think crypto is really the only way that it's possible for some of us to go up and ascend, get our first couple $100,000 in crypto. You will be, if you stick out with crypto for the next 2 years, there is no way in hell you don't hit your first couple $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to $100,000. Now, if you're really doing it and you're really putting it in, like, I think you can touch $1 million plus in 2 to 3 years. I really believe that. But that's for a person that's really like putting it all in. Now, if you're kind of passively, I don't see why not. You can't, like, if you're putting, like, I don't know, $10,000-$15,000 a year into crypto over the next 2 years, you should be able to see, you know, high five figures to like low six figure portfolio. And that's still pretty life changing. That puts you into this position where then the next cycle, whoo, you're hitting millions. But that's beautiful, man. Acorn sauce, that's right. Hit the like button, man. $5 for free. Oh my God. It went from this to like some fucking white people walking on the beach. I love it. All right, full screen is
properly addressing and managing the transfer of a generation's wealth could be the make or break for an economy. If it is not handled correctly, it could genuinely see assets and businesses go without the stewardship they relied on under their previous owners. But to give context to this whole issue, it is important to understand first what is being passed down. The collective value of expected inheritance over the next few decades are by some estimates approaching $100 trillion worldwide.
Woo! $100 trillion going to be passed along. Damn, son. What, the crypto market's barely $1 trillion. So these boomers are going to give us 100x. No. But all jokes aside, but probably I would imagine probably like $3 trillion or is... Fuck, what was the number? I can't remember the number. I think it was like 30 trillion. I forgot how much it was liquid assets of that 100 trillion, but if I remember correctly, maybe like $9 trillion is liquid stocks, assets and stuff that you could transfer over. So I would imagine over this sort of time, probably $3 trillion of that, $9 trillion, a third of it's going to be probably invested into crypto. So remember, $3 trillion entering crypto over 10 years is not just $3 trillion. Because that's not really how it works. So when you put $3 trillion in, you're probably pulling it. You probably would actually increase the market cap of crypto to $9 trillion, $10 trillion with the $3 trillion going in. Because there's such a limited supply that it just ratchets up the price very high. So, shing, very good.
This worldwide figure is a little bit less concrete and a lot harder to reliably quantify than the USA, where records tend to be a little bit more rigid. In the US, the number that we are looking at is $30 trillion, of which about $9 trillion is in the form of typical liquid and semi-liquid assets. This is stuff like cash, cars, boats, Beanie Baby collections, share portfolios, and houses. All of this money changing hands is bound to give a boost to the wallets of a younger generation, which has famously been saddled with economic headwinds like student loan debts, stagnant wages, and turbulent job markets. You might be forgiven for thinking this is great. It is finally going to give millennials the healthy financial boost that they need to get into homes or unsaddle themselves of debt or just become bigger spenders in the economy.
Yo, I don't know what's this hate on avocado toast. But like, how did this become a meme, dude? This, the Hispanics, the Asians, the Blacks. Yo, when is someone's avocado? I've never in my life seen anyone eat avocado toast. Not once.
I eat avocado
toast. Oh my God, Travis.
Here, let me give everyone a reference. There you go. That's all you need to know.
Hit a Pepe. Oh my Lord. Damn, Travis.
It's good. It doesn't look like that. That's gross. It's literally just avocado.
I really believe it's because it's has a lot to do because of the financial. I would imagine just because the most outspoken of them are probably in the financial market. And it's a lot. Whatever. It just is what it is. I ain't going to go into it. I ain't race baiting today. But it does look good with salt, though. Hey, but like this is like this obsession of avocado. It's like it's I don't know. Whatever. Though I am Hispanic, so we do eat guacamole and shit. So maybe I shouldn't talk.
And while there are definitely going to be some good things that come from this transfer, it may not all be good news. But from the top, the first impact this will have is an upwards pressure on demand. A paper published by the American Economic Review found that around 70% of households who received an inheritance windfall had spent all of the money within the space of 5 years. This is obviously terrible financial management on their behalf, but for the wider economy, that frivolous spending will create jobs and business opportunities for people.
Capitalism at its finest, you guys. That is right. Now, people don't believe me when I said this, because I got some flack for saying this, right? I said, like, if you have, like, 400... Now, Let's just say you made some money off of crypto. Let's just say you made 400,000, like and I don't think really a lot of you guys will make that $400,000 million range and shit in this next bull market. Now, for a year or two, sheesh, you're out here. That is really, it is a lot of money. But if you try to like think about it, if you put 400, now you say, watch Miguel, like what ends up happening when you make that kind of money, you do have lifestyle creep. And it's not really bad lifestyle creep. Now you actually get to go to the fucking doctor. You actually have a nice car. You can actually help your family out. But you find out how little that kind of money, it's not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. Doesn't, but comparatively to your life beforehand, oh, it's incredible. Yeah. If you had that $400,000 and you only were like, okay, I'm going to give myself 40,000 of it extra this year. That's the responsible way to do it. But I don't know. It's really not a lot of capital and stuff like that. It really sounds irresponsible. Like, how could you have burned through that much money in 5 years and stuff like that? It's not that crazy, especially if you're like, you got to imagine like people like us who are having like your money is your ASIC, right? And by ASIC, you know, Bitcoin miners, right? Like you need Bitcoin miners and the electricity in order to mine BTC that gives you your money, right? Well, in crypto and in people who are in the capital class, like me and you and the rest of the 200 people watching right now, your capital, your ASICs, those $400,000 in this example, are the money that you need to reinvest. So I would imagine that $200,000 that's going back to the markets, you really only have like $200,000, and then on top of that, there's taxes on that on selling that stuff. So it really is not as much capital as you think it is, but it isn't. It does put you in a really nice position. But regardless or not, this spending is really good for the economy because you know this buys Escalades and cars and houses, down payments for this and that and stuff like that. And the thing is, a lot of the people in our generation haven't had the capital or the ability to have that capital to actually put themselves in line. Like if you actually look statistically of where the boomers were compared to the millennials, we're really behind. So a lot of us have to play catch up in order to get to our houses and actually start a family. So we're playing catch up. So I really don't like, I really see for people who get this kind of windfall, I totally understand why they would burn through a lot of that capital. It's because a lot of us are having to catch up to where we should be and beyond and stuff. A lot of people have been putting their life on pause, and I think that's bullshit. So now if someone's really old and they burn through that money, I give, yeah, like what the fuck is your old ass doing? But if a person, no, for real, but if a person's 30 years old, 25, like maybe 45, you know, 40, like I give them a lot more leniency on spending, on burning through that much capital versus someone that is like, if you're 58 or 60, like old person, what are you doing? You know what I mean? Like you really should have everything by that point and really should be saving that for retirement or doing something like that versus someone that's young. Like they're probably gonna use the money to start a family and get a house, you know, or medical bills or paying off student loans and stuff like that. It makes sense. I finally get to afford the chiropractor and the extra 9mm. That's right, Crypto Boogie. Jesus Christ.
Old. Who received an inheritance windfall had spent all under an upwards pressure on demand. A paper published by the American Economic Review found that around 70% of households who received an inheritance windfall had spent all of the money within the space of 5 years. Sheesh. This is obviously terrible financial management on their behalf, but for the wider economy, that frivolous spending will create jobs and business opportunities for people, probably people in the jet ski industry. And it is worth quickly...
Shout out Rolo.
Noting that this paper and its findings are old. It was originally published in 1959 and then revised in 1961. But since then, consumers' marginal propensity to consume has only risen, meaning that for every extra dollar people are receiving, they are spending a larger portion of it rather than saving. Also, more recent but less comprehensive studies are still finding the same figures. This is an interesting phenomenon, and there are a few things to pull apart from these transfers. For starters, smaller inheritances are more likely to be squandered. Now, obviously, it is easier to spend less money than it is to spend up more money, but it actually has more to do with what this money can do. An inheritance of less than $100,000 is not necessarily life-changing for most US citizens. Don't get me wrong, it's a lot of money, but it won't let the average person quit their job, and it probably won't accommodate a house purchase either. Of course, $100,000 would be a healthy deposit for a house pretty much anywhere in the world, but it would still be up to the recipient of this inheritance to qualify for financing for the remainder of the purchase price. An asset-based inheritance may give some injection of cash, but it doesn't increase the recipient's income or polish up their credit score. So often,
this is why crypto is so important, because like now we have a place where we actually can put some of that capital and then we can get multiples on it, right? This is kind of the beautiful thing where if you were to take that $100,000inheritance, right, and after taxes and stuff, right, imagine you were able to put not even 50,000, let's just say 40,000, 35,000, and put it into like half into Ethereum and then into a plethora of shit coins. That I don't see over the next 2 years. Now, we are at the bottom of a bear market, which we're very close to the bottom of a bear market. That 35,000 over the next 2 years, I have no, there's like no doubt in my mind that would go to like $350,000 to $500,000 over the next 2 years. Right? And then, so then the rest of it then can be used to other things. Now, that whole down payment thing, it's very true, because like some people get, they get these inheritances and they really don't have a business and they're kind of wage cucking out here. And yeah, it just is what it is. Now, I do recommend, now I think the best investment is always in yourself and education, crypto mindset, baby, the Citadel. But if you already had your own business and it was starting to make some money, I think that money would be one of the best places to put it, would be probably back into your own business or to lower down debt in your own. I really believe in a debt-free life if you can afford to do that. I don't like having debt myself personally, but I understand it's a bit of a tool for people, but you have to kind of play it by ear, right? But they are right. $100,000 really isn't a lot, but it is kind of a big stepping stone. I really believe $35,000, if invested correctly in crypto, could turn to $350,000 to $500,000 over the next 2 years. Nowhere else can you do that, and that's not even like being a degenerate asshole with a whole $100K.
Sometimes it's difficult to deploy this capital effectively, at least
except crypto mindset.
For use in buying a home. Now, of course, the relatively financially savvy viewers that make up the audience of an economics-based YouTube channel will probably point out alternative investments like the stock market. And this is not a bad plan, but in reality, most average people are scared of investing directly into shares.
They're not wrong. That's actually very true. We're going to pause the video a lot, man, because it's like he's like spitting facts right now. It's true. The average person does not like have their financial education is garbage, filthy. I mean, like, if you're lucky in high school, they teach you like how to balance a checkbook. Like, bitch, we don't even make checks anymore. We use Zelle, and then I fucking like give me your Ethereum address. I'll send you some Ethereum. Like, what are we talking about here, right? But the average person's financial literacy is very, very bad, and they're putting everything on credit cards for the most part because 3% cash back at Chase. But you know, it's just a sad state of affairs and stuff like that. So just like he's saying, that people who watch these kind of economic videos have a higher propensity for money, as well as people who watch dollar cost crypto and cultivate crypto. Pretty top of the pyramid here in terms of like having control of their money and stuff like that. A lot of people are legitimately very. I never understood that. I really do think the average person could actually pick better stocks than what's in the 401k, like legitimately. I mean, if you think over this next bull market, if you were like Kathy Woods just investing into like the fucking hype shit, you would have done extremely well for yourself. But there is the whole thing of like when you're up a lot, you do have to take some profits. And I think that's really where the strategy really does take a bit of an L, is like you have to like have like, let me put some money into cash. And I think that's the part that we're going to be like, we're really starting to teach this in the courses now, but like really teaching this in the next crypto mindset course that we have is making sure to take profits and everything like that. And but those profits have a point, a portion of it back into your real life to make sure that the person who's generating these things has a better life and can have more clearer thoughts and stuff. And the other part is to save it there to then put into new investments as well as new opportunities that they have. It's kind of nice.
A 2016 Gallup poll noted that only around 25% of Americans are directly invested into shares outside of things like their 401k and their Roth IRAs. Now, considering the median inheritance in the USA is actually only $69,000, it is reasonable to expect that a lot of this money will be squandered rather than deployed into investments that will increase the standard of living for the recipients long term. Another important point to note is that while the median inheritance size is $69,000, the average inheritance size is $700,000. What this means is that a large majority of this wealth transfer is coming from and going to wealthy households. Now, For the more regular recipients, there is one other option available to handle this cash, and that is paying off debt. The average student loan debt in the USA is $32,731 as of 2019, according to the Federal Reserve Bank.
Now, that's a lot of money, but like, damn, when I think of that, I really don't think that's a lot of money. But I'm ruined because of crypto. Like, I've got people in here who's got more than $32,000 in a shitcoin. Like, I know guys that have like fucking like $200,000 in like in Boink or in like a meme coin on SHIB in the SHIB ecosystem. They do in student loans for a lot of people, right? But like, it's your network is your net worth, you guys. You gotta get around people. Join the Citadel, you guys. Links in the bio. But like, you gotta get around people that have the kind of money that they can afford to throw in like $500,000 into a fucking shitcoin.
Bank. This is ignoring consumer debt. A financial windfall like this might just motivate people to pay out debt, which on an individual level is probably pretty responsible, but economy-wide, it means no consumption and no investment, which makes GDP figures sad. Yep, this is all ignoring the big, which makes
I gotta say that meme again.
GDP figures sad.
Great Depression, the big sad.
Yep, this is all ignoring the big elephant in the room. So far, we have only looked at a paltry $9 trillion worth of this wealth transfer. Now, this $9 trillion comes from pretty much any asset type that you can slap a price tag on. So it begs the question, where is the remaining $21 trillion coming from? Well, it's coming from a vast collection of private companies. Private companies, those are businesses that are incorporated but not publicly listed, make up a majority of wealth held by individuals over the age of 65. These businesses can be anything from a family restaurant to Coke Industries, but it tends to be that business owners control a larger portion of wealth.
Why do I say, you guys, that you got like you have to own your own business, or you just have to be very, very, you have to be all in into the as a capital class investor? This whole working for now, you can have a really great job and earns really great money, but fuck being a wage cuck. You either have to own your own business, and of course you're trying to provide the best, you know, income and lifestyle for your employees and stuff like that. And I think you can work somewhere and really make it. But it is a sort of thing where like the average job that people can get is pretty shitty. And I really believe that, you know, if you really want to have a decent lifestyle and be able to invest in stuff like that, you really do need to get yourself to a point where you're earning $200,000. And I really believe if you start your own business and anyone who's really like hustling into their own business and really trying to like grow it can within a very relatively short period of time get it to $100,000. Now, probably 70,000 is profit, 30,000 is cost and stuff like that, which is probably very true. But over time, like I really believe like most small businesses can probably grow to that $200,000 range, $300,000 range before you get problems into actually expanding it out. But this is kind of like the big problem here too, is like I think they say it later in the video, but like half of the businesses in the United States are small, like half of the GDP of the United States is really like small businesses. And some of these, like this is kind of the problem, is like transferring off the business off to the next generation is terrible. Like I know people who their fathers don't trust them and aren't like should have already given them a lot more power in the business and just kind of hold it over them. And there's a lot of like family politics. And this is kind of the shitty thing where like your family's wealth and money come from a small business and that sort of thing. And I think a small business classified under 300 employees and stuff like that. But like, I would legitimately say a small business, because if you're in a business and you're, let's just say your father or your mother runs a business and they have like 20, 30 employees, like that's probably the top end of a small business. Like what I would classify as a small business. But, because if your family has like a business where they have 100+ employees, shout out to my boy Jay Waller, but 100+ employees, that is actually a pretty big business on average. Like that is a huge business for a small business, actually. Like you should be very well off with like 100+ employees if you have something, even if they're all minimum wage. Like that is still a very large business that should generate quite a lot of capital on itself. But I need to start an egg farm, but for sure, man. But it is that sort of thing. Like I dealt with this myself, and I have friends who've dealt with this and stuff. I have families that are, all my family owns, like my whole family has like family businesses. They're in the construction industry, from like, landscaping, real estate, painting, plumbing. The only thing we're missing is electrician, but like concrete, stone masonry work and stuff like all they all had these separate type of companies and stuff like that, as well as we knew friends of friends that all had these companies and everything like that. And oh my God, that's one of the biggest things, is just like the father or the mother who's controlling the business isn't like passing along that or giving them raises, or like it's just kind of like you're just like stuck in this position and stuff like that. And then this is kind of a problem where like then they don't give control of the business soon enough to the next generation. But then the reason that they don't do it is because, especially if it's a third generation business, is that the second generation who's in control now just got control of it for the last 10, 15 years. But then now their kids have gone to the position where like they're like, fuck, I just got control of this business. Now I'm making money and I've got to give it over to the next generation. And I think who I think is a dumbass. And they might be true too as well. So it's like, it's such a touchy thing.
Another quick side note is that this figure includes trusts. Trusts are an effective way to disperse assets to beneficiaries before and after the death of an individual that is contributing to these entities. I will leave a link in the description to a video that properly describes the ins and outs of trust structures, but in short, they are basically just buckets of assets with designated managers which control the money for the benefit of, well, the beneficiaries. These entities are particularly popular amongst wealthy individuals because it means that they can give money to their children while leaving something like a law firm in charge of actually managing the money. This means that they can set rules and limitations about how the money is accessed and used, like they can only draw a certain amount per year, or the beneficiary needs to get a college degree to access the money, or whatever weird and wonderful stipulations rich people come up with to control their children beyond the grave. All of this is, of course, why wealthy children get the title of a trust fund baby. But wealth inequality argument aside, trust funds and trust fund babies are...
Now, let me say a little thing about the whole trust fund thing. Now, this one has really fucked my mind up really thinking about it, because, like, if you notice, right, we work our asses off trying to get rich so we can give our family and our children a better life. But then they're, like, chastised within society for, like, oh, you're a trust fund kid. Now, you want... Like, you think about it. Do you, like... Like, there's this whole thing of like giving your kids nothing and then having them struggle for it versus like, but most people, if you're being honest, like you're trying to give your kids the next level up because you had to struggle so hard to get it. But the reason that you're at your position is because you struggle so hard to get it. But here's this kind of a fucked up reality is that most people's kids, like, would probably not make it at all. Like this is really like a messed up sort of thinking, but if you really think about it, right, like the reason like you're like you guys are the successful ones in the family is because you guys really wanted it, and it, like there is something innate, not just ability, but just a want. I don't give a fuck what IQ anyone has outside of just like where it really they can't, you know, they're like outside of like being lower than 70 a 70 IQ or something like that. I really believe it doesn't matter the IQ you have from like 80 upwards. If somebody really, really wants it and really works towards it, and if it's really their goal, they're going to achieve financial independence and really make money in this world. But there's this whole thing where like you could have children that they're more into just like being an artist or doing something like that, or like it's not really money focused. It's more like, and this is kind of the problem with it, where like giving them that wealth does put them in an advantage where they can follow their dreams and stuff versus you can just give the money to a kid who's like the go-getter and then he's going to kill it, right? But it's really not just there's like kind of a nurture and nature versus nurture sort of thing where like kids out the box come out like entrepreneurial versus you pushing that on them. And of course some parents really suck at pushing the right things on their kids, but there really is this whole thing about kids really like off the jump they were about the money, right? I don't know about you, man, but like you can ask my mom, like you can ask my mom, I was talking about cash since I was little. Like literally, like you could ask my mom, like, my mom was like literally telling me, like I was bringing up newspapers about the gold price since I was like maybe like 5 or 6 years old. Like, mama, we should buy gold right now. The gold, like, I had this little old piece of newspaper that was like from like 2 years ago that I picked up in like Miss Montenegro's class. Shout out to my grade school teacher. But that like I had this old little piece of paper that I forgot what it was, like the price of gold was like $50 or $40 or something. And then now it was like $120. It was like, we should buy gold. And this thing's going up. Like you imagine as a kid, you had the sense of like, yo, this thing, the number is this and the number is that. Like, bro, it might be this in the future. We should get some. But, you know, but there is that whole sort of thing, right? But it kind of begs the question of, like, you're making your kids softer with having them all this wealth and money and stuff like that. But it also, there's a huge responsibility as a parent to really push these good things on them. And I really do feel like there's lazy parents out here. And, I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about this, but this is more chastising, like, parents and stuff. Like, if a kid comes out shitty, like, now there is just kids that come out the box kind of fucked up, but there's this whole thing too of, like, you have to put a lot of blame on the parents as well. Like, you know, if the kid comes out fucked up, like, you were just a shitty parent as well and stuff like that, you know. So I don't know, I'm talking to my ass here.
Not necessarily the problem here. It's more so the genuine businesses that are out there functioning day to day. Imagine an auto mechanic shop. A majority of the value of that business will come from its ability to actually fix cars. If this business gets passed along, there will be no guarantee that the beneficiaries of the previous proprietor will be technically proficient in auto repairs. In this very simple example, what that would mean is that this business would lose a good portion of its value. Now, for larger businesses, it's relatively simple to put employees into place that can handle the day-to-day operations, but it still can be very destabilizing when an owner leaves the business. Put it like this. How many examples are there out there of businesses that have been successfully run by a CEO after they were promoted into that role from their previous position as son of the CEO? Of course, successful handovers
show the Trump Tower. That's funny as fuck.
Do happen, but reputations exist for a reason. A US Census Bureau study found that 2/3 of family businesses do not survive the transition from the first generation to the second.
Now, you guys want some tea right here? Like, I think one of the reasons why I did so well in the industry my dad was in is because my dad literally was going out of his way to not have me in that industry. He was trying his fucking best to, like, bully me not to do what he did. And I said, fuck that old man. I'm going to do it better than you will. I don't know. Maybe it's because he was, like, on opposite mode with me. He wanted me to, like, be a blue, like a white, he wanted me to be a lawyer and a white collar guy and stuff like that, which, I think if I was really good at school, I probably would have done it myself, but I just wasn't, like, I just hated sitting down in a classroom. I can't do it. It's just, that wasn't me. But, so I made that intentional off because, like, that was the best option I had. So I was like, well, let me go into industry where, like, I have the most connections to grow in because I can, because at least I get to be outside and kind of listen to stuff because I was so tired of being in school already. But that wasn't a very advanced emotional decision of mine at the time. But at the time, it seemed like a horrible decision. But if you want it, you can get it and stuff like that. But, it's tough. It's that nurture versus nature shit. I mean, it really is.
Of those that do survive, only about 50% make it to the third generation. Even for people that don't have a lovely family business coming their way, this is a real concern. Family-run, small to medium-sized enterprises made up about 50% of the USA's gross national product in 2019. In many other countries around the world, this figure is even higher. If 50% of these businesses go bust, that will mean job losses, productivity losses, and supply chain problems for the entire world.
Now, when you hear a politician say, I support small businesses and stuff, yet they keep increasing the taxes on the small business and on the middle class. The middle class business owner is the backbone of America, and they keep putting things to hurt them and stuff like that. So this is kind of this bullshit, bro. Like, they're trying to crush small businesses because they hurt big businesses because big businesses can't be as agile as a small business in terms of, like, pivoting and stuff like that. But it's crock of shit. Fucking politicians.
Of course, there will be businesses that come in and replace the businesses that shut down, but these transitions are not always as smooth as the perfect little economic assumptions that we make. Structural inefficiencies are going to be a major concern during the post-boomer boom. Now, with so much at stake, the logical question is to ask, how is this all being managed? Or more specifically, how is this being taxed? Most developed nations in the world today have some form of estate tax that is levied on the passing down of assets. This includes the United States, where there is a federal tax of 40% that is charged for estates over the value of $11.68 million. Ugh. Of course, Given this high value, the charges don't apply to 99.9% of inheritances, but for those that do, those charges can be pretty steep. Multi-million dollar estates are more likely to involve some kind of family business, which raises the question of accelerating the problems that we saw earlier. If a business is struggling through a leadership transition, the last thing that they will need is for Uncle Sam to stick his hand out and ask for 40% of their value paid out in cash. This may very well force the beneficiaries to just sell the business off to cover the tax burden, which will again cause business turmoil.
And then send those, usually those families into dire straits over the next generation, and then they're poor again. So that's kind of messed up sort of things. You took literally the thing their family worked very hard for that's kicking off money, and they've had to sell it now because there's no way they have the money to actually do it. That's, if you actually look at the House of Gucci, that's what ended up happening, is that the if you guys ever I watched a movie, it's a pretty good movie and stuff, makes you hate luxury goods, but what ends up happening there is basically the father dies, and then they have to come up with a ton in it was a huge tax bill. And then that's what caused them to like kind of lie about some of the transition stuff and signatures and stuff like that. So they didn't, because they didn't have the money to actually, like, he was about to lose his family business that they've had for, I don't know, like two generations because of these huge death taxes and stuff. Like, what the fuck is, like, why? I mean, there should not be any taxes on these kind of businesses and stuff, like, especially if it's family businesses.
An entire industry has actually grown around this, where institutions like insurance companies will offer policies to cover this estate tax burden. Beyond this, it must be recognized that the actual valuations given to family companies can be pretty fluid. More often than not, these institutions are valued lower than they probably should be for reporting purposes. Even more to the point, an $11 million family business would likely have some kind of succession plan in place with pre-existing employees in executive positions. Now, the argument for an estate tax is that, sure, it might cause turbulence in these large institutions during a transition phase, but that can be planned for. Even if it means taking on a loan, selling some shares in the business, or, let's be honest, sitting down with an estate lawyer and jumping through some loopholes. This tax provides strong revenue from people that can, of course, afford it, while also reducing the tax burden on smaller businesses or regular folks that might only get a few $1,000s in their trust fund. A best of both worlds approach has been presented as just taxing businesses more during their regular operations to avoid the massive disturbances that come from this transition period. But let us all know what you think the best way for governments to handle the great wealth transfer will be in the comments section below. As always, we will discuss the most upvoted answer in this week's Q&A. Until then, we can rest easy knowing that estate taxes are doing exactly what wealthy business owners want them to do. Taxing them over their dead bodies.
That's a good one. Now I'm going to go to the next video, which is the younger generations are now poorer because of their parents. So this is more of a boomer hate video on it, but both of them had to do a lot with the boomers and the, I would say, what's going to happen over this next period of time as they start dying and retiring and stuff. So yeah, put us on the screen. Let's go.
Old men plant trees whose shade they know they shall never sit in. A Greek proverb from a time well before the problems of our modern economies or the study of economics itself is as true today as it was thousands of years ago. But do we really live by this idea? For the first time since the Industrial Revolution, successive generations are not becoming wealthier than their parents. While there have certainly been setbacks and historical outliers from this trend, it has remained true in aggregate for the populations of most developed economies. For a long time, it was simply the expectation that people's children would have a better lifestyle in their adulthood than they did. But today, that really is no longer the expectation. In fact, most young professionals can only aspire to live the lifestyles that their parents did. Younger generations are finding it harder and harder to get reliable jobs, afford comfortable homes, start a family, and save for retirement.
And I'd say intrinsically, this is kind of what I believed and stuff, and I still believe to myself, and why I push myself so hard. Is I wanted to have a better life than my parents had and get to the point where, like, I could help them out and stuff like that. And then hopefully my kids, and I hope that they feel this kind of pressure as well. Like, they need to have a better life or do better and stuff like that. Obviously following their own dreams and stuff like that, of course. But, like, if I have an artist as a kid, man, he's going to be making some Skrilla. Like, he's like, I don't know, at my household, that's probably why we're in the push. But, It is this whole thing where, like, you know, you need a like, I haven't given up on that dream, and I think it is possible, but I think a lot of people, there's also kind of a defeatist sort of like mentality on that. A lot of my people in my generation, the millennials and stuff, they kind of feel like everything's so bad. The woe is me. But, and like, I've always believed that whole, like, pull yourself up by the bootstrap sort of shit. But, you know, in order to actually have it, to actually be able to accomplish it, you do need hope, you know? So a lot of people, I feel like a lot of people are kind of like hopeless.
This is despite the fact that the world is a much richer place today than it was at any point in the 20th century when baby boomers were busy building their now unassailable fortunes. So, what is going on here? How is it that a world that is richer overall, producing generations that are poorer than the ones that preceded them? Is there some underlying cause to this? If there is there some way to reverse it? And if there isn't, does that mean that we can only expect every generation going forward to be poorer than the one that came before it from now on? Oh, and I suppose it's probably also worth asking, does this even matter, since everyone is eventually going to die and pass down their wealth anyway? Here's a question for you all. Is it better to be born into a large cohort with lots of people the same age as you, or a small cohort with not a lot of people the same age as you? Traditional economic theory would suggest that a small cohort is preferable. It means less competition for jobs, housing, social programs, spots in good schools, and, on a macro level, less competition for things as basic as natural resources. But how then do you explain the baby boomers, which, despite being part of the largest population explosion ever, are in aggregate very wealthy? Well, Lord David Willetts, a British politician, demographer...
What a name. Lord David Willetts. That is crazy. Member of the House of Lords of the United Kingdom. I mean the UK, dude.
And author suggests that the opposite may be true, and that in a democratic system, being part of a larger cohort is actually preferable because it gives that group more voting power on generational issues and more sway in marketplaces. When the boomers were young, they voted for policies that benefited them.
Now, I'm going to pause this here, right? Now, this is a really important thing. So, this is really the reason why this hasn't really panned out that much for us in terms of millennials and stuff is because normally, right, like the next generation is larger than the previous generation. So when they were entering the workforce and they were starting to vote, they could actually sway votes against even their parents in order to pass things that they wanted and needed in the actual economy. Now, here's the difference, is because our generations are almost the same in versus each other, as well as usually when you're younger, more of your population doesn't vote. So it's like, as we get older, we tend to vote more, versus when we're younger, we don't tend to vote as much. So because you had a lot of the boomers, mostly the large portion of the boomers were voting, and then you had even the millennials who should have been voting, and their vote, because if we should have been 50% larger than them, but that's just not how it ended up working out. Because of that, we didn't sway as many things our way, voting wise. Because what should have happened is the millennial generation should have been able, and some of the extras should have been able to sway the votes away from what the boomers wanted for the younger generation. But because the boomers were so powerful and they were so big, and their generation was so much larger than usually how this thing, because demographically this thing is still a little off. The millennial generation should have been 50% larger than the boomer generation. We're actually a tad small. We're still like on par with them, slightly larger. But realistically, we should have been a lot larger if you look historically how generations are supposed to go. So the whole voting thing got kind of swayed out in control, and they ended up having much more control over the over the votes and stuff much longer than they should have. This is kind of weird. Like right now, the Congress should be half millennial, half Xer and stuff like that. It should be a third boomer, third Xer, third millennial, and it's like 80% a boomer right now. So they've had a fucking iron grip over Congress. They really shouldn't have and stuff like that. So we're almost waiting for these fuckers to die off so we can actually have younger people in, which is insane. That's kind of one of the reasons the country's a little fucked up in terms of our stuff, because regardless or not, it shouldn't have been a thing. Now I don't believe this whole having free shit, like having free college and all this crap, but a lot of our generation probably would have voted for it. So if college was free, we wouldn't be saddled with so much debt anyway. So it just is what it is.
Low-cost or free higher education, family support systems, and strong social welfare. When they got to the peaks of their careers, their voting patterns changed again, and now this large block of voters was in favour of lower income taxes, less business regulation, more domestic industry protections to avoid outsourcing and global competition, and on a smaller scale, things like zoning laws which would protect the value of their homes. The push towards suburbs with mandated single-family building requirements meant that houses got bigger and good locations got more desirable because only so many family homes could be built there. In the 50s, houses were basically a commodity. The majority of the expense was in building the structure itself.
And let me know if you guys want for the like next week's stream or something like that, because I'm trying to have one of these kind of react video streams once a week. Let me know if you want one on real estate. If you guys want one on real estate, I'll definitely do a couple videos on real estate and kind of give my thoughts on stuff, what's going on with like our the transition from real estate being a commodity to an actual asset class and what problems it's caused, as well as kind of benefits as well. There's a lot of like cases for both sides. Like I think we've actually gained quite a lot of it becoming an asset, but it's also caused things of like not everyone can get homes anymore. But if you also think about it, traditionally, I'm looking Hispanic, like Spanish, you know, Spanish, French, Portuguese. And even German, really, like realistically, you actually had a lot of multiple generations living under one giant household and farm traditionally throughout human history and stuff like that. So we're kind of almost returning to the home roots, but a lot of people want to get away from their parents and stuff. So it just is what it is. Would you, if you guys want, all right, you got it. All right, and I'll look for some bids and stuff like that. And I'll do a whole kind of like video presentation on like real estate. Heck yeah, man.
And it wasn't unreasonable for the family cars to cost more than the family home. Fast forward 50 years and those houses are now investments as much as they are places to live. In old age, the boomers have now started voting to support retirement benefits, pension schemes.
Pension schemes. Pension schemes. Remove the wealth taxes. All right, remove the wealth taxes. All right, I'm cool with that. Middle income, that's good. Support. Like, I don't hate on any of these things, right? But I don't know about pension schemes. But if you had more of an even sort of Congress right now, you'd probably have things of like getting, like you would have had things to have like, you. I really think it's a really fucked up sort of way how we've guaranteed, like, I think the really big thing I would have voted against, and I think a lot of people would have having these sort of loans. I think what really fixed this whole thing is having guaranteed loans for people to go to school. And then, because the debt follows you anywhere. So because there are guarantees, that means the debt can't be defaulted on. Everyone gets a loan. I mean, if you were, like, one of the quickest ways to solve all this stuff is just basically have it where the debt can disappear, or the debt can disappear and stuff. And then because of that, you would end up having you would have these people who end up giving loans to students. It would evaporate like overnight. I mean, you'd probably have like a 95% or like erase of this. The reason college was so special and the reason why like college would be able to earn you more income is because less people will be able to go, and because less people will be able to go, it would actually matter in the workplace because there was a scarcity to it. But if everyone can get a college degree, then it's kind of not just worthless, but unless it was teaching you an actual trade or skill, which most people aren't going, they're going for a 4-year fuck spree basically. Which, hey, I ain't hating on it, man, but, you know, you got to do it on your own dime. You want to go fuck around for 4 years.
Medical infrastructure and to remove wealth taxes, even if that comes at the expense of all the schemes that serve them well in their young age. Of course, David Willett's work focuses specifically on the UK, and yes, I know there are certainly people that vote for the greater good rather than their narrow self-interest, but on average, it is easy to see this trend throughout the past half century in most advanced economies. In my own home of Australia, for example, the 2019 federal election was more or less decided by a policy decision that would reduce the tax effectiveness of Australian retirement accounts. The party that advocated for keeping the favourable tax structure ended up winning, primarily thanks to older Australian voters. We recently just had another election where that opposition party backed down on their plan to change retirement account taxes, and they won, very convincingly. A 2017 British election study found that over time, votes for Conservative parties have shifted from being divided by rich and working class to being divided by young and old. A lot of what I have discussed so far came directly from Willett's book, The Pinch, and a lecture he ran at the Royal Institution. It's definitely worth a read if you are interested in these demographic processes.
The Pinch, how baby boomers took their children's future and why they should give it back. This guy's base, bro. Okay, I might have to give it. You know what? I'm going to give that book a read, man. I'll tell you if it's good or not.
Now, a lifetime of favourable government policy can be hugely beneficial to building wealth. Imagine how much better off the average millennial would be if they got free college or secondary schooling.
Now, I think this is true. Now, if it was all free, cool, right? But I've said this a lot of times in my I've said this without understanding this a lot of times, and then now, like, really thinking back on it, I've really put this into, like, context and stuff. A lot of the times, what you need to do is just start. But if the barrier to entry is this high, how can you ever start? It's like one of the biggest things that we've complained about over these last, like, I would say 15 years has been, like, people get out of college and they're like, I have a college degree and they want 5 years experience, but how can I get the experience if I don't have the job? But the entry level job is asking for 5 years experience. How can I get, like, there's that whole thing. It's like, how the fuck can I get the job if I can't get the experience to start the job? And then the entry level positions already asking me for 5 years experience. That's the clusterfuck of the whole thing right there. So, that's funny, but that's the sort of thing. It's like like being able to start, right? This is why I was I give a lot of shit to Robinhood. I do like Robinhood and like Acorns and all these things because they lower the barrier of entry into investing to such a low thing that there's no excuse. And then a lot of times it's just squirreling a little capital away until eventually you have enough money where then you can make some moves. That's the power. I remember when I first got out of high school that, and if I wanted to start a brokerage account or something like that, or get invested into stocks, it was costing me about, what was it, $10,000 to $8,000 to start an account. I didn't have that kind of money back then. And because of that, I started way later. Imagine if I was able to start my investment journey 4 years sooner, 5 years sooner. That would have been incredible. Like, I wasn't able to start until like 2011, really. And it was barely anything at all. Like, imagine if I was able to do it since like 2008, 2009, where I would be today, because I would have had so much more capital, you guys. If I was able to invest for those three extra years, probably cost me out on millions of dollars, because I think someone in the stream in the comment section asked me, where did I make my first million? Was it in the first cycle of crypto or the second? It was in the second. If I had those three extra years in the market, I would have hit the million in the first cycle. Who the hell knows where I'd be right now in terms of that's how, like, these, like, planting those little, like, the best time to plant the seed of a tree would have been like 10 years ago, right? But the second best time is now. But if I had those extra 3 years, who knows where I could have been, because that those little seedlings could have actually turned into some real capital and stuff. So, interesting. Let me go back a little bit.
Imagine how much better off the average millennial would be if they got free college or secondary schooling. Even all other things being equal, this would be the difference that a lot of young people need to be able to put a deposit on a house. And that's the next big issue to consider, the housing divide. David Willett's small cohort theory probably omits, or at least doesn't emphasise, one important detail that gave baby boomers another advantage over successive generations. And no, it's not simply that they were able to buy houses when they were cheap. Certainly that didn't hurt, but it's more a symptom of a bigger issue. They were a big cohort in a small world. They had all of the voting power and hardly any of the competition. In the 1950s and 1960s, the global population was roughly a third of what it is today. And not to start a whole thing here, but if you were a white man in the countries that we are mostly focusing on, your competition was even less severe. So, this added back all of the apparent trade-offs that we thought of earlier. There really was less competition for basically everything, including jobs, because employers had a smaller pool of labour to choose from. Labour force participation amongst women was very low, which further reduced the supply and hence the bargaining power of workers. But it also meant that domestic duties...
Which means basically because women enter the workforce, they made your labour worth less. Because there's more of people, so it's like... There is this huge... Now, I'm not saying this for everything, but, like, there really is, like, if you, I mean, I, you probably could get rid of half of female jobs and the economy would be A-okay, because I really believe, like, half of them are kind of bullshit jobs anyway. I'm not talking about doctors or pharmacists or, like, things in the medical field, but, like, half of female jobs are total rubbish for the most part, and I think that if you got rid of them, you would actually end up having, like, increasing wages for men and stuff like that, and I think overall it would end up being pretty well for the economy, and you'd get some of these women to have kids, which is good for the fucking economy, Ponzi.
were normally taken care of, which reduced household expenditures on things like childcare, food, and general maintenance. These higher relative incomes combined with lower outgoings meant that houses could often be paid off with as little as 1 year's income. Yes, they did have to endure higher interest rates, especially in the 70s and 80s, which were their peak home buying decades. But it didn't.
And that's true too, especially for police, fire, and military. Bro, like half the stuff that comes out for women in the, not just in the military, but like, now I do support a lot of women in the military and stuff, but like active combat roles or like trying to compete with the boys, like it's so sad. Now, some of them are badass women. I'm not trying to like insinuate anything terrible, like they're really trying, but like there's strength requirements that you need for this stuff. Like if you told me right now, there's a burning building, I'm on the floor right now. Let's just say you have your mother. She's in a burning building. She's passed out. Would you rather her get saved by a female firefighter or a male firefighter on the second or third floor of a burning building? I don't know about you, man, but I get sexist real quick, and I'm saying the male firefighter every fucking single time. Unless he's a string, it's a string beam. Now, if she was like a Mrs. Olympia winner or something like that, no, like obviously I'll choose that cart right there. But outside of like these crazy sort of things, right? I mean, it's just you want a man in these kind of positions, military as well, police. Like, do you want a female dude? Half the time, if we're in a physical confrontation and shit, the female police officer is gonna get her fucking ass whooped. And they're more likely to use a gun to make a situation more dangerous as well. Now, you could have untrained male cops and stuff that use the gun more often and stuff like that. But if you're looking at both situations and stuff like that, you'd rather want a more burly, strong guy in those positions. Now, just is what it is.
Really make the difference it would today. The median home in the USA in 1985 was $82,000. That's median, so 50% of homes, like the ones first home buyers would be looking at, would be cheaper than this, but let's keep it simple and stick with $82,000. Adjusted for median household incomes, that $82,000...
A little bit what he's talking about here is actually kind of the point I've been trying to talk about to you guys in crypto about don't chase yield. Don't chase yield, just get the get the coins you like and then get the yield you can, right? But this is kind of a way of sort of saying it, like, it's all about the entry price. Right. If the look, you could have like they could have 17% yield because interest rate from the Fed is increased so much. But if the price of the house is so cheap anyway, you will still end up buying that house faster with that higher interest rate, just because the cost of the house is so much cheaper. Versus you could have a very high price of the house, but the low rate and stuff like that, it doesn't really equal out as well. So that's why, like, I really believe like housing prices are going to continue to go down at least for the next year, because even though the interest rates have gone up and stuff like that, it's the price of the house are still so expensive that even with the prices going down 10-15%, the increasing rate still made them even more. They're actually more expensive to get into, with the price being down because the interest rate's so up. So we're in a kind of a crazy situation where I think house prices need to come down an additional probably 20-30% before people will start really pulling the trigger. But there is a huge need for housing and stuff. So I'm going to restart this whole thing on this whole housing data. You guys could check this out.
Little as 1 year's income. Yes, they did have to endure higher interest rates, especially in the 70s and 80s, which were their peak home buying decades. It didn't really make the difference it would today. The median home in the USA in 1985 was $82,000. That's median, so 50% of homes, like the ones first home buyers would be looking at, would be cheaper than this, but let's keep it simple.
Medium home, so the average home is $82,000, but most people's first home is probably 50 grand in the 80s. 50 G's, you guys. 50 G's.
Simple and stick with $82,000. Adjusted for median household incomes, that $82,000 becomes $103,000. The average mortgage rate at this time was 15%, or roughly $15,000 per year. It did get higher in certain years, but most borrowers were fixed in at an absolute max of about 15%. So that's the worst case scenario. The median home today costs $430,000, and the average interest rate is just over 5%, or $21,500 per year, just in interest payments. Again, this is adjusted for median incomes at the time, so on the surface, these seem pretty comparable. Maybe the younger generations shouldn't be complaining about unaffordable housing after all. A lot of people brush away this comparison by saying that inflation at this time was extremely high, so these higher interest rate payments didn't mean anything. But that's actually not true. Inflation in 1985 was 3.5%, and while it was as high as 13.5% in 1980, this was consumer price index inflation, not housing inflation. The prices of houses throughout these decades actually grew at a relatively modest rate. It was everything else that was getting expensive. This is kind of the opposite of what we expect today, where house price growth outpaces inflation. But it was not the case
So what he's talking about is correct, but he forgot to mention one thing, is that we also have everything else getting more expensive too. So not only is the housing going up, we also have the CPI stuff going up as well. So, and shout out to all my egg founders out here, killing it this year.
The 70s and the 80s. So yeah, the inflation argument isn't totally fair. So is it fair to complain about how easy it was for baby boomers to buy a house? Well, no. They still had it easy for two other big reasons. It's not what you would expect, but the higher interest rates actually kind of helped them. Saving money for a deposit in an account that pays 10% interest per year really accelerates that savings goal. Higher interest rates also ensure that...
So what he's talking about here is because the interest rate was so damn high from the Federal Reserve. So let's just say the real rate of the Federal Reserve was 11%. Or let's just say it's 11%. And the bank was paying you 10% for saving. Because you were like, wow, I'm earning 10% of my money. More people would save more money in the bank. And it would actually cause this kind of positive feedback loop of an actual good sort of thing to save capital and money. Because you would put money, like, imagine that. Imagine it's 12%. I think that'd be a cooler sort of thing. Imagine you're getting 12% a year. That means, like, every month you have 1% more capital in your bank. So imagine you have $100,000 in the bank saved up, as just an example. You would have $1,000 of yield show up in your bank every month. That's really nice. That would actually be pretty cool. Can you imagine that shit? That you get to the point where you have like $200,000 in the bank saved up, and then you're every month you're an extra $2,000 are showing up. Who the fuck would not be saying save money? Because like that would be like a guaranteed safe yield of $2,000 in your bank account. Then that you could just fuck off $1,500 of that and keep growing your saving balance and stuff like that.
But house prices never got too high because the repayments would just become unaffordable. In our example from before, we were looking at interest paid on the loans from two time periods. But the thing with a mortgage is you gotta pay back the principal as well. Paying back the principal on a $430,000 mortgage over a standard 30-year loan term will cost an additional $14,300 per year, bring the total annual repayment to just under $36,000. The house from 1985 would have a principal repayment of $3,000 per year, bringing the total repayment to just over $18,000 per year, half of what the 2022 home buyer would be paying, despite interest rates being three times higher. Put another way, if the repayments were kept equal, the person buying the home in 1985 could have it paid off in 5 years rather than 30 years. So, why am I focusing so much on housing? Well, despite being a very important part of our lives, houses are also uniquely unproductive. Real estate is kind of unique as an asset class because it doesn't produce anything of value. A house sitting on a block of land can appreciate in value and can provide a home to its owners or a rental income stream to an investor, but it doesn't make anything. Of course, there are other investments today, like cryptocurrencies, that also don't produce anything.
Yo, this fool's coming out of left field real quick. I don't know about this video anymore. Whoa, I feel like I'm personally attacked right now.
Of course, they're up.
This is haram. I will not stand for cryptocurrency slander on this channel. But I will forgive this transgression. Wow, I can't even speak today. Oh, well, whatever.
Transgression.
There we go. The caffeine hit me.
are other investments today, like cryptocurrencies, that also don't produce anything of value, but their market is minuscule next to the market for real estate.
Oh, this video's from a minute ago, bro. It's 2.3. I wish we're at $2.3 trillion. Oh, the good old days, you guys. Sheesh. Can you imagine if your coins were up 2.35x up right now? Lol. Oh my God, man.
Estate around the world. Minuscule and also irrelevant. If the value of Bitcoin goes to $1 million, well, that's great for the people that invest in it, and it will have some minor knock-on impacts in other markets as people cash out to buy whatever crypto millionaires buy, but it's not going to put anybody out on the street. Housing affordability can do that, and it can also slow the progress.
Okay, okay, I'll give him a little bit. Okay. All right, he kind of redeemed himself here at the end here. Okay, I was feeling very deeply attacked right now over my bags and shit, but he's like, okay, I understand what he's saying. Yeah, Bitcoin went to it would have some knock on effects because regardless of how you have any asset class go to zero, it would have terrible knock on effects for the rest of the market. But I see what he means. Yeah, basically, if real estate gets so expensive that people can't afford homes, it causes homeless things. But I do believe a large part of the homeless problem is a mental health sort of thing, as well as a lot of people are fucking lazy. Let's just be for real, and just drug addicts and stuff. And then you guys should look into the opium wars with China and stuff like that. And that was mostly that wasn't the United States. That was the UK doing that bullshit. Now China's trying to do that shit to us with fentanyl and everything like that. So, man, you'll fuck those motherfuckers. You want to ask why I want their economy to fucking crater? That's why. So let's go back and for the slander. Yo, I'd get my, well, I don't know. I would get that car, but eh.
So irrelevant. If the value of Bitcoin goes to $1 million, well, that's great for the people that invest in it, and it will have some minor knock-on impacts in other markets as people cash out to buy whatever crypto millionaires buy. But it's not going to put anybody out on the street. Housing affordability can do that, and it can also slow the progress of entire economies. Every economy in the world is still, for better or worse, focused around large centres of economic activity, what a regular person might call a city. If the real estate in these cities becomes too expensive, then it becomes infeasible for workers to hold down jobs there because more and more of their income will just go to paying rent. In the short term, this can be offset by higher wages, but then these centres are really just operating for the benefit of the landlords that are lucky enough to own property there. The money that landlords make from their properties are unlikely to be reinvested into company growth or spent on regular consumer consumption that keeps these businesses in business. It is likely to be spent on more property, further driving up market values and the amount of money that gets sucked out of productive centres to be shoved into unproductive assets. Higher house prices also reduce social and geographical mobility. A 2020 Pew Research study found that 52% of young American adults between the ages of 18 and 28 still live at home with their parents. One could also reasonably assume that this number is higher after 2 years of COVID.
Now, we'll say this, though. I think that's both bad and good at the same time. Now, I want to talk about some good effects of like people living with their parents for a little bit longer is that... Now, this is more of a boomer thing and shit where, like, they couldn't wait to get away from their parents and stuff, right? Because free love, man. Free love, man. I'm in the mud pit fucking, like, some armpit chick, man. All this hippie love, man. No socks, no all sex, bro. No condom sex or whatever, or contraceptive sex, man. But one good thing, I would say this is kind of a benefit that's not really talked about a lot, is I think that actually a lot more, now I think people always have people throughout history have always had this horrible relationship with their parents, always, right? But I will say this, though, that older Xers and boomers are the parents of the millennials, that I feel like a lot of the boomers who did end up having their kids and then having their kids live with them for an extra 5 or 10 extra years with them have probably a much better relationship with their parents and probably is going to end up a huge benefit for the boomers. Another benefit for the boomers is that their millennial children are probably going to support them through retirement a lot more because they have a better, deeper relationship, right? I mean, as a millennial that did live with his parents for a while and stuff like that, and so did a lot of other people, is you know, you do feel this whole thing of like, my parents are really helping me out and one day I'm going to help them out and stuff like that. Like, so I do feel like there is more of a of a wanting from the millennial children to help their family out, because they you know when you're living with your parents and stuff and you're like they're really helping you out, that like I'm gonna help them out one day and stuff, like it isn't just like tit for tat. It's kind of tit for tat, but it's like you do feel like this kind of like intergenerational kind of like debt to them as well. So there is a benefit there.
Record high house price growth. These young adults are financially bound to where their parents live. If they get offered a really good job in a different city, they would have to decide if it's worth the pay increase versus the increased cost of living on their own. If they decide it's not, then they miss out on a good job and a business misses out on a productive worker. The concentration of wealth in a particular generation is something that can have very real consequences for entire economies, and these effects are only going to get more pronounced as populations continue to age. Places like Japan are clear examples of this, and they don't have the same kind of housing problems that we do in the West. But long term, does this even matter? I don't want to get too morbid here, but people eventually die, and their wealth will get transferred down to their children or some other beneficiary. So the concentration of wealth in a single generation is at worst a transient issue. I actually
don't you hate that shit when the grandparents are so much nicer to the grandkids? And you're like, where the fuck was this love? Where? Tell me. Like I bet you, I don't know, like, I don't have kids yet, but could you imagine, like, you see your parents are such fucking hard asses, and then you have some kids and they come over and they're like the sweetest people in the world, and you're like, since when? Since when have you been this nice? Huh? Monica gets the love? Miguel over here gets this fucking, the lashings? And she, whew, I'd be heated as a fucking parent, man. Oh my God, bro. That shit would boil my blood privately.
Die, and their wealth will get transferred down to their children or some other beneficiary. So the concentration of wealth in a single generation is at worst a transient issue. I actually made an entire video last year about the Great Wealth Transfer, which is the process of the baby boomers dying and leaving their wealth behind. Yep. The problem we discovered in that video was that a lot of the wealth that is being passed down is coming in the form of private family businesses. In brief, the problem with that is that often these small businesses need the owner to continue operations, and the people that stand to inherit these businesses are either unwilling or unable to run them. Small businesses are a huge part of the economy, and losing them will do a lot of harm. Now, a glimmer of hope here is that these businesses can be sold by their inheritors to people that do have the skills and desire needed to run them. Perhaps they will sell them to people who have themselves got the money they need to buy the business from their own inheritances. The problem here is the type of people that will actually be receiving this money. Most people don't receive money from their parents passing until they are pretty old themselves, often approaching the end of their careers or starting retirement. If the money gets handed down to them, they are likely just going to use it to fund their own retirements and then just...
Yeah, that's kind of like one of the problems with... there should be sort of a tiered system where it does you do transfer some money like early, but some parents aren't in that. But I outside of the people, the parents that just don't have it like that, I think that is kind of a thing where like you should give your kids something. Like I'm not talking about like giving them at 15 or some crazy, like other than education. But there should be some. I think 26 or 28 years old is a good age to give like some the younger generation some capital there to, for them to like, even if they want to fuck it off, it just is what it is. But like to give them something to, for them to like try to accomplish a dream or something like that. Because what ends up happening is that most of this wealth transfer ends up happening to, and the majority of it gets given out to your parents. Let's just say your grandparents died. The grandparents leave a little something to you, but then most of it gets given to your parents, and then they mostly use it. Not to build up the business, but just for their own retirement. So it's like the money just gets from retirement, it gets given to retirement instead of actually given to like the ones that are trying to build up something or create the business and stuff, where like your parents, by the time that they are your grandparents are dying, they've already had their kind of their life already in sort already.
But how many children have things that their grandparents can even invest in?
How so?
Basically what I'm saying is like, yeah, okay, my grandparent has a lot of money.
Right.
But me as a wage slave, yeah. What am I going to do? Ask them for money to what? To invest into my business and to invest into something I'm building, or like,
well,
it's just a better standard of living.
Well, part of it's a better standard of living. The other part is to try to do something. Cause like the thing is like you, hopefully, holy God, hopefully none of us like, my dream was to work at, I don't want to shit on Riley, but like I work at Target my whole life. right? I don't think of a single person here is like, but even the person who works at Target is like, if he's like, no, I've wanted to work at Target my whole life, but he's trying to be the manager or the guy of the store. You know what I mean? Like, you're just working there because it's kind of a pass through job for the most part. And then from there, you're trying to do something. So like that capital, be like, use this money to, even if it's stupid, at least try to get your stupid, like, I'd rather have tried the stupid idea and failed than have not tried the idea. Like, there's a bunch of people who are working at these jobs and stuff that are like, they just never got the shot or the capital to try the dream out. As stupid as it is, you'd be surprised, the stupid thing might work. Like, you would rather have like, well, I tried and I failed it, but I failed it. Like, I tried. Like, I much rather give the person, I'd rather blow the money on a shot than not, you know? But that's just the risk taker in me.
Just hand down whatever's left to their own elderly children. Money pooling in the hands of older people means less opportunity will be afforded to younger people to do all of the things that they do to build a functioning economy. Buying a house, getting a good job, and, you know, starting a family so that there is a continual supply of workers to run an economy. You can't run an economy on people waiting to get old enough to finally do something with their lives. Economists...
Yeah, and that's the same sort of thing that ends up happening in the... that happens in the family businesses as well, which is like, it's just such a tough sort of thing where like as an example, let's just say grandfather, the father, and then the son, right? The son ends up like wasting a ton of potential and like not gaining as much money or doing his stuff he wants to do with his life because he's waiting for this little carrot for the father. Then the grandfather dies. Now the father's in control, and then the father's holding this carrot. It's like, if you gotta stay working with me for a while, and I'll hand you the keys to the castle. And then by the time the keys to the castle sort of come to the kid, he's like in his early 40s. Or late 30s and stuff, where like he may have just fucked off and gone to another business or done something else, or have been just like, or have been under the thumb of the. It's a really tough thing with the family businesses, and I've seen this first and foremost with a lot of businesses, a lot of them.
Starting a family so that there is a continual supply of workers to run an economy. You can't run an economy on people waiting to get old enough to finally do something with their lives. Economists call this the intergenerational wealth problem. I like to call it the Prince Charles paradox, but it is something that we are going to have to address. Things like wealth and estate taxes are commonly proposed solutions, but even if they did work, they are going to be very unpopular amongst the huge voting bloc that got us here in the first place. The final thing we've got to ask ourselves is this all the boomers' fault? I know a little bit of intergenerational bickering is all good fun, but blaming our current economic issues on a single generation is not going to be very productive. Voting in your own best interests and policies being enacted in the best interests of the majority is the foundation of democracy. And I don't think that...
Wow, hexadecimal. My grandfather promised my father the family business and then he sold it to the Chinese. Yikes. Yo, bro, that is fucking out here, bro. Dude, I'm sorry, I had to stop the stream for like a second. That comment took me out, dude. My grandfather promised my father the family business and then he sold it to the Chinese. Give me a pepe for that. Holy shit. And that's some of the tough stuff when it comes to the business side. Now, I know, I'm not going to say who this is, but I know someone in my life and stuff that basically he's been working for his father and his grandfather for a long time, and he's busting his ass, and he's been waiting for him to be able to give a little bit more control in the business, and his dad might be end up selling it to an employee instead of him, just because his dad thinks that he's going to run the business into the ground or something, which I don't think he will, but... it's kind of fucked up. And then now he's wasted a good portion of his life waiting for that opportunity to like take control or own his own version of the store or something like that. It's just damn, dude. Like family, that's some of the problem with the family business stuff is like, oh, it's so tough.
That anybody is reasonably going to argue that this is a bad thing. I think it's also very important to look at examples of economies where this has not happened. The second largest economy in the world, China, is a great counterexample. Their generational baby boomers are known locally as the Lost Generation because they spent most of their working life in a dysfunctional economic system. They were also too old...
Shout out to Mao, baby. You.
...to truly benefit from the rapid economic expansion that took place in the decades after the economy started opening up. This meant that despite still being a large portion of the population, they did not enjoy the same economic prosperity as their Western peers. Economic prosperity was also something that the boomers enjoyed that wasn't necessarily within their control. The last half of the 20th century, by historical standards, was very peaceful. The world also opened up to...
Because of the American Empire control over the world and the one world currency, the dollar.
...international trade, and growth was put into overdrive by an abundance of cheap energy in the form of fossil fuels. It was a great time to make a fortune, and people did, which is probably the final piece of the puzzle. Once people become extremely rich, and I'm talking about multimillionaires and billionaires here, they don't normally become poor again. The clump of billionaires that came from this generation will be skewing these figures to make them look worse than they really are. Remember, in a group with one billionaire and 999 people who are completely broke, the average member of that group is a millionaire. Most billionaires are pretty old, and these people will be making outsized impacts on their generational wealth statistics. Again, if we look at billionaires by age in China, a country where voting by the general population doesn't really happen in the traditional sense, we can clearly see that wealth comes from periods of strong economic conditions, not just having the ability to bend public policy to suit you.
So I don't truly believe all the shit he's saying here, but in terms of what's going on, what he's trying to say is because that's the end of the video right there. But what he's trying to say right here is a lot of the boomers from China really didn't get to see like the economic growth and stuff like that, which I think that's kind of a lie as well, because they did see a lot. They went from farm to industrializing, which is kind of a big dramatic sort of thing. But I think he's sort of capping here a little bit. It's a little bit of a cap, but you're right in terms of like living like boomers here in America. Of course, yeah. Like Western boomers did a lot better life-wise, like legitimately life-wise versus the Chinese boomer. But the most amount of poverty was destroyed with the rise of wealth in China and stuff like that. So you had a lot of people who could have died of starvation to the point where like they're not dying of starvation, and now they live in like these buildings and stuff, and the amount infant mortality down, the longer lifespans increased, better living conditions, more medical supply, you know, everything got increased, technology and everything like that. So that isn't all true, but the boomer generation of China kind of fucked up, and that's mostly, this is what, getting government involved. Like if China, imagine if the Chinese government wasn't so retarded, and they didn't put all these one child policy craps, and all these sort of like limitations, you wouldn't have made it a sort of a normal sort of thing. What happened was, you would have probably had an equal population, because there's still a lot of poor people in China. You probably would have had China also having an equal sized population in terms of their percentage of boomers to millennials to the United States. So I think China would have been in a really much more stronger position, not over the United States, but just in their sort of thing. So they could have had maybe another generation of crazy growth, another 20, 30, 40 years of growth. But because of things done because of the Communist Party and Mao and all those other dumb fucks, capital letter dumb fucks, doing these really stupid things, they've kind of destroyed they destroyed a lot of their future right now, and then probably they're going to have their country split into three separate countries, and a lot of people dying because of famine and stuff over these next 10-20 years. So yikes. But with that, you guys, thank you so much for joining me. You guys can follow me at, of course, this channel, hit the like and subscribe button, and I'll be back Saturday with a hex specific stream. If for some reason from after the surgery, if I'm just not able to see or something like that, then I'll just reschedule that stream for probably Tuesday. But with that, you guys, thank you so much for joining me, and catch you guys later.